Hey, it's Greg Brown. Grab your logbook, because it's time for another cockpit adventure from the flying carpet. I'm an aviation author, adventure columnist, photographer, former National Flight Instructor of the Year, and Barnes & Noble Arizona Author of the Month. The flying carpet is a four-place single-engine light airplane. In it, my wife Jean and I have long traveled the North American continent, searching behind clouds for the real America, and experiencing aerial adventures like today's all along the way. Learn more at my website, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com, where you can also see photos from most episodes. And I'd appreciate your feedback in my Flying Carpet Podcast Facebook group. One thing I love about flying is that travel has so many dimensions to it. It might be as simple as going from point A to point B for a meeting or a $100 hamburger. But sometimes it takes you mystically and magically to faraway places spiritually or places in time. And that's what this story is about. It's about time travel. So climb into my flying carpet, buckle up your seatbelts, and prepare for takeoff on today's adventure. Clear prop. Today you're traveling back with me to way back in 1971. I was a new freshman at University of Wisconsin in Madison. And along with the adventure of leaving home for the first time and making new friends, I was embarking on two other adventures that were extracurricular. One of them was I began flying lessons. It would take me about a year to knock off my license. But shortly after school started, I began driving my old Chevy from the dorm out to what was then called Truax Field at Madison, Wisconsin. It was all the way on the other side of town, and I started flying lessons. About the same time, someone approached me, and I don't remember who or how this happened, but a law student who played banjo was putting together a bluegrass and country band. And somehow they heard that I played fiddle, and I was invited to join. Now, there were four of us in the band. The organizer, Ed Fife, was the law student, very talented on banjo, and a great guy, and also loved the public eye and was a great announcer. And then the guitarist and I suppose lead singer, Roger Borland, had quite a bit of musical experience, more than most of us. And the bass player was a guy named Jamie Sheldon. Jamie was a super talented bass player, glue that we desperately needed at a time when first we were new playing together and someone like myself who had never done improvisational music before, it was great to have that foundation of the bass player. Plus, he was a terrific singer. In any case, we practiced together a few times, and Ed proposed a name, the Yahara River Valley Boys. Now, few of you will know the Yahara River, even if you've been to Madison, Wisconsin, but it's a relatively short river that runs just through Dane and Rock counties and empties into the Rock River. And the relevance of it to our group was it is the river that connects the four lakes upon which Madison, Wisconsin is sited. Madison's a beautiful town. It's only a half mile wide in the middle where the state capital is and between Lakes Mendota and Monona out of the four lakes. Absolutely gorgeous spot. In any case, we began practicing and playing together and we were certainly rough around the edges. I was. But after we'd practiced half a dozen times and started to get some things together, Ed suggested we should record the music. So we invited all of our friends between us, maybe 20, 30 people at most, to 216 Langdon Street, which would have been on Frat Row, except all the frats were out of business in those days during the late 60s, early 70s. And we gathered everyone in the lobby downstairs, and we turned on the tape recorder, and we recorded ourselves playing. And later on, I pulled out my trusty old Nickermat. I was already an active photographer even through high school, and took a bunch of promo pictures for the band because we had big plans for where we were going to go with this band. After playing a number of free gigs around town, we ended up getting some other gigs further away. I remember we drove up to Green Bay in my old car and performed up there at a night spot. That was a big deal. And at the time, I remember I became concerned. The violin that I played, my dad had bought for me when I was taking classical training in grade school and high school. It was a nice instrument. And I was worried, since we were now starting to play in bars, that it might get damaged or stolen. So I happened to be at a flea market in Milwaukee, and they had two fiddles on one of the flea market tables for sale. One was $15, and the other was $25. Now, the $15 fiddle had no strings on it, so I couldn't determine how the tone was, though it was certainly a good deal. But the $25 fiddle had one string on it, and I was able to tune it up adequately and play it enough to hear it had pretty good tone. So I thought, okay, this is going to make a good bar instrument. Now, although we played a number of gigs, the total life of this band was probably only about 10 months. And so I have relatively few memories of specific gigs. One exception to that is we played at a country bar across Lake Mendota in a town called Wanakee. And the band was right at the front of this bar, and they were largely farm folk, having a good time. There was a lot of alcohol flowing, and they were dancing to our music, and we really felt top-notch. And there was a woman right at the front, and right in front of the stage, dancing with her husband or boyfriend or whatever. And this lady was an amputee of one arm. She had no prosthesis, and she was smoking. And I vividly remember that each time she was ready for a new cigarette, she would strike a match off the stump of her arm. And every time she did that, the band would skip a beat. Anyway, the guys in the band were a nice bunch, and one in particular, the bass player, Jamie, he and I became close friends in this relatively short time. We really enjoyed each other's company, and we had a lot of shared interests. And we agreed that we were going to rent an apartment together for our sophomore year. Freshman year, I'd been in the dorm, like most people do. So Jamie and I went looking, and we found this apartment on State Street, which is a hopping part of campus town. We signed for this apartment. But shortly thereafter, Jamie told me that he was sorry to disappoint me, but he had decided he was going to drop out of school and go pro as a musician. And again, this guy was very talented, so I understood completely. It was a bummer. I had to advertise in the paper for a roommate who did not turn out to be half as good as Jamie would have been. In any case, this took place in May of 1972. The same month I soloed an airplane for the first time. End of freshman year. So Jamie went away. I can't remember if Ed graduated right then from law school or not, but even though we had done all this preparation, that was the end of the Ahara River Valley Boys. Now, I was able to reconnect with Roger maybe 10 years ago. All these guys were far better musicians than me. Roger had a really amazing career and ended up as head of the music department at UCLA, composed music for all kinds of different genres, including movies, and he had just a fantastic career. Ed, the organizer of the band and a great guy, disappeared, and so did Jamie. I never heard from them again. Until, in summer of 2022, about a year and a half ago, for the umpteenth time, I got the bug to look for Jamie and found a similar name on a band website in Boston. The band was called the No Static Band, and it's a Steely Dan tribute band. In any case, I looked at the pictures and I thought, wow, one of those guys could be Jamie. Now, keep in mind, I hadn't seen him since 1972. So this was a little over 50 years later. So I sent a note via the band website and said, hey, Jamie, this is Greg Brown. We were in the Yahara River Valley Boys together. If that's you and you're up to it, I'd love to hear from you. Well, within a couple hours, I got an email back, and sure enough, it was Jamie. So I was just thrilled about this, and he seemed to be too. So that afternoon, while out for a walk on the nearby wetlands, I pulled out my phone and I FaceTimed him, and we had a great time talking and catching up a little bit. He had played professionally over all these years, including one of the most notable names he played with was a guy named Vassar Clements. Now, those of you who listen to bluegrass, you'll probably know who Vassar Clements was. Probably the best-known fiddler in bluegrass for many years. Those of you who are not bluegrass fans, you may still know of him because he played on rock albums also, including with the Grateful Dead. In any case, Jamie had had a great career, and this No Static Band has got gigs all over the Northeast, and on occasion they've played with original Steely Dan players and caught up a little bit about our pasts. I mentioned to him that I had a couple keepsakes he might find interesting. One was, I had a dozen or so slides, those publicity photos I took with my old knicker mat in spring of 1972. And I thought he would enjoy seeing those, and he said, you bet I'd enjoy seeing them. But the other thing I had, and this was really a gem in a sense, I still had a cassette tape of that several hours of recording we had done at 216 Langdon Street when we were getting ready to go on the road. So you can imagine that was something Jamie wanted to hear.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, we're the Yahara River Valley Boys. That's Yahara as in Yaha. Live and in concert from 216 Langdon. We'd like to introduce Roger Borland as he sings You Ain't Going Nowhere.
So I took that tape and I digitized it and I sent it to him, sent the digital files, and Jamie turned out to be a whiz at audio editing, and he worked his magic on the songs and sent them back. And, you know, it was recorded under far less than professional circumstances, And frankly, the band's quality was such that it did not deserve professional recording. But it took us back to Ed Fife's bantering and introducing the band members and talking about the different songs, and then our bantering with each other in the band and comments from the audience.
We'd like to introduce our bass player now, who very gratefully joined us in singing that last song after a moment's cueing. And he's going to sing our male chauvinist song for you for the evening. And that's called "You're Not a Drop in the Bucket When It Comes to Loving Me." Is that a clap of recognition back there? Or? Jamie?
Yeah?
Would you like to sing the song? Yes, very much, Ed.
So it was more than the music, but the music was a kick because it took us back all those years to 216 Langdon Street with our friends of the day. We could picture them out there. We could picture the scene. So that was a really exciting thing.
Get to see the city, get to see that city. Let's go to that land.
Come on, little children.
Come on,
little children.
Come on, little children.
Let's go to that land.
So this was all really cool. We're like, we got to get together. Then Jamie and I launched for the umpteenth time a search trying to find Ed Fife. And we have never been able to determine where he ended up. He was an attorney, as I mentioned, and he ended up practicing in Honolulu. That much we were able to find, but we have never been able to track him down. So we hope he's not passed, because it would be a kick to connect with him too. He was a great guy. Now, it turned out that Jamie's son, one of his sons, had recently moved to Tucson. And I live in northern Arizona in Flagstaff. So Tucson's several hundred miles away, but it's well within flying carpet range. So I was like, Jamie, next time you come out, you got to let me know and we're going to get together. Well, fall passed. We got into spring. I get a message from Jamie. He and his wife, Judy, are going to be in Tucson for a week. And bummer, it turned out to be the week that my wife and I were going on vacation far away. And we certainly weren't going to cancel vacation to fly down and see him. But enter the flying carpet. That's how you go see people you haven't seen for 50 years. However, we couldn't do it because we were gone. And they left before we returned. So that was a big disappointment. So then we're like, well, you know what? One of our sons lives in upstate New York, and next time we come out your way, we'll be flying out there, we'll hop over to Boston, and we'll get together with you guys. So come last fall, my wife had a high school reunion, and she's from Northern Illinois. So we decided, you know what, we're going to go to the reunion and visit our friends and relatives in the Chicago area and up in southern Wisconsin. And then we're going to hop back into the flying carpet and continue east. And we'll visit some dear friends in Quebec. We'll go see our son and daughter-in-law in upstate New York. And I contacted Jamie and said, how about if we fly into an airport just west of Boston and spend a day with you? So he and Judy set up this incredible plan where we were going to fly over there and land at this airport. They were going to come out and meet us, and then we were going to go to Concord and Lexington and walk the historic streets of those Revolutionary War sites and have lunch at a special place that they love over there. So we set this whole thing up. We get into the flying carpet in September, and we fly east. Now, from Flagstaff to Chicago in a 182, depending on the wind, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 7-8 hours of flight time, which we can do in one stop in our Skylane. It's a longer trip on the way back because of headwinds. But in any case, we flew out there. We had an enjoyable weekend. Jean went to her reunion, and we saw relatives on both sides of the family. But those of you who live out east may remember Tropical Storm Ophelia. It came ashore in the southeast in early September of 2023, last fall. And then it worked its way up into the mid-Atlantic area and the northeast, and it sat there as a tropical storm and a tropical depression for weeks with huge quantities of rain, thunderstorms, low IFR weather, instrument flying weather. So we're in Chicago getting ready to take off for the next leg of this trip, first up to Quebec and then over to upstate New York and Boston. And it gets to be the night before, and I'm looking at this weather and thinking, this is hundreds and hundreds of miles of bad weather with no sign of ending. Now, I'm instrument rated, and the flying carpet is nicely instrument equipped. But anytime you're in a single engine plane and you're going to fly hundreds and hundreds of miles with uncertain convective weather and a lot of low IFR, you're thinking, well, one, if anything goes wrong, I got a problem. And at best, we could get stranded someplace halfway and never get to where we were going. So I called a weather briefer at flight service and spent about an hour with him on the phone the night before our departure. And I said, am I missing something? Or does it look to you like this tropical depression is going to sit on top of the east indefinitely? So he looked at all the information with me, and we struggled over it and both agreed that there was no indication that this was going to clear anytime soon. So I thought, well, I'll take another look in the morning. We're still going to give this a try. That evening, we went to dinner with my brother and his wife and had a great time. And then Jean and I went out to the airport, Aurora Municipal, if you know that place, in southwest side of Chicago. And I checked weather. And that same big blob of weather was sitting there with no sign of moving. It did not look like a good day to go flying east, and there was no sign it was going to improve anytime soon. So, and I've never done this in over 50 years of flying, I've never had to throw up my hands and say, we simply cannot go. But in this particular case, Jean and I looked at each other, and we could see that we could be stuck for days and still not get out east. So we loaded up the flying carpet, and instead of flying my filed flight plan northeastward, we turned southwestward and headed for Arizona. And even at that, the weather was pretty tough. We had to fly through some fairly nasty IFR, but it got better as we went west. As always going west, we had horrific headwinds. We landed at Garden City to refuel, and probably a total of 10 hours flight time, we finally got home. So that was a horrendous disappointment for us. And the whole way back, that whole 10 hours, all I could think about was, I hope I made the right decision. I'm missing out on seeing my son and dear friends and Jamie Sheldon and his wife in Boston. So, of course, I contacted Jamie as well as everybody else. I actually texted him from the airplane and said, sorry, Charlie, we're not coming. And I said to Jamie, you know, hopefully you'll be out to visit your son in Tucson again this spring, and then we can get together. Now, I have to tell you that For days afterwards, I was fretting about whether we made the right decision in not completing this trip because we knew it would be at least a year before we could go again. And I'd probably still be fretting about it today, except that in the days that followed, the Northeast was inundated with flooding from heavy rains and thunderstorms. So Gene and I were able to look at each other within a week or so and say, you know what? We made a wise decision by not attempting to continue east at that time. Fast forward to this month, April. Jamie had dropped me a note. They would be in Tucson for 1 week. Monday, the day after Easter, April 1st, April Fool's Day, was the perfect day if we could come that day. Otherwise, plans were developing through the week, so we agreed, let's shoot for April 1st. Now, those of you who've flown the Southwest much know that we generally have very good flying weather around here. And Arizona, of course, is legendary for its good weather. But we live up in the mountains, about 100 miles north of Phoenix, and Tucson is about 100 miles southeast of Phoenix. So, as the weekend approached, we're watching a big storm system come in, and I was hopeful right up until Monday morning when we were supposed to take off that we might be able to go, but we got 4 inches of snow, it was low IFR, no flying in the mountains in a 182 with no de-ice or anti-ice on it when we've got snowfall and convective activity, so it was terrible. For the third time in a year and a half, we were unable to go meet up. So I contact Jamie and I said, do we have any option? And he said, well, I can make tomorrow, Tuesday work, but for the rest of the week, we've got family plans and it would be really tough to change. So Tuesday morning, Gene and I get up. The weather was clearing. It was very windy. There was low-level wind shear, and accordingly, low-level turbulence was forecast. Tucson still had broken clouds, but they were at a reasonable altitude, about 4,000 feet. So we took off from Flagstaff. Yes, it was bumpy, really bumpy. In fact, Gene and I had to hold onto our seats at points in the flight. But it didn't matter. You expect magic during time travel. And we found it. Here we are flying over the beautiful Arizona countryside, over Sedona, over Phoenix, Picacho Peak, all this beautiful terrain. And we go from snow-covered landscape where we live to this beautiful Sonoran desert populated with cacti and flowers. Dodging scattered clouds, we descended toward our destination of Avra Valley Airport at Marana, Arizona, which is just north of Tucson and has a wonderful little cafe, the Skyrider Cafe. It fronts on the highway, and then the other side, you can park your airplane right there and walk past these beautiful saguaro cacti right inside. There was a ton of traffic in the pattern, airplane shooting instrument approaches, and practicing landings. There was parachute jumping going on, so we were dodging all this traffic and trying to be extra careful. We landed. We taxi into the parking spots right next to the Skyrider Cafe, shut down the flying carpet, chain it down, and walk to the gate. We recorded the code for getting back out the gate. As you pilots know, that's always on the ramp side, and you need it to get back out. We opened up the gate. Here comes this tall guy who looks strangely familiar. And it was Jamie Sheldon. First time the two of us had seen each other since May of 1972. You never know exactly how this sort of thing will be. If you're like me, you've probably met some old friends and it was like old home week, and other old friends, it's like the magic has gone away and they're not particularly interested in getting together. But Jamie and I picked up our conversation right where it left off, 1 month short of 52 years ago. You know, I'm pretty convinced that what makes for a long-lasting friendship is if you have interests that go beyond shared memories, you know, that it's more than we did three fun things together. The friendship included a higher plane. And in this case, we just fit right back into where we were. We had a good time sharing our life stories, and we had a lot of commonalities we never would have anticipated in terms of the type of careers we had, work we had done. I tremendously envy Jamie because although he went to school and had a terrific IT career in addition to music, he also played professionally that whole time. Whereas one reason why I think I'm nostalgic about this is that that little band, the Ahara River Valley Boys, was my one foray into professional music, and I enjoyed it a lot, and I'm sure I would have become a lot better had I had the opportunity to stick with it. We only had an hour or two together, and it was a delight seeing Jamie and meeting his lovely wife, Judy, and introducing my wife, Jean, to them. Although our reunion was far too brief, it was clearly a beginning, a renewal of this special friendship from all those decades ago, not an ending. So hopefully next time we fly out east, the weather will permit us to go all the way to Boston. And hopefully when Jamie and Judy are out here visiting their son, we'll get other opportunities to spend more time together. But I just had to share with you this experience because I know it sounds weird, but had we driven the 4 hours each way to Tucson, it wouldn't be the same. Flying an airplane, which we call the flying carpet for good reason, it magically takes you places that are, like I said, way further than the next town or the next state. There's an emotional side of it. It's like magic. And to meet a dear old friend and reconnect was something special. I hope you've gotten a hint as to how much and why this was so special for us. I do have one postscript I would like to share with you. My original violin that my dad bought me years ago ended up with my older son, who is a professional musician. But the fiddle I bought in Milwaukee in its old wooden case, the one I bought for $25, that has been in my closet for all these years and only rarely taken out, which is sad. But about 10 years ago, I took that instrument into a violin repair shop and had them look it over and make some adjustments to it so it was playable because it had been sitting for so long. And to my astonishment, the technician, who was a very sharp guy and did a lot of work for symphony orchestra musicians, he said to me, "Oh, this is a really nice instrument. This is a handmade German instrument and it's probably worth several thousand dollars." So one thing I got out of this story is that it's probably the only investment I've made in my life that turned out to be a winning ticket, that the violin I bought for $25 at a flea market turns out to be a desirable, reputable instrument worth a couple $1,000. So I just had to share that with you. Thank you.
go back to the garden seated. And stay with your home knocker. Go back to the bathroom.
Thanks for riding along on today's Flying Carpet Adventure. Please help me continue this podcast by sharing your favorite Flying Carpet episodes on social media, posting reviews on your favorite podcast directories, and donating via my Greg Brown Flying Carpet website. Thanks in advance for your support. You can find photos from most episodes at my website, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, please check out my book of aviation adventure stories, Flying Carpet, The Soul of an Airplane, for which I was named Barnes & Noble Arizona Author of the Month. Learn about that and my other aviation books at gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. Also at gregbrownflyingcarpet.com, you'll find my Views from the Flying Carpet aerial photography, available in fine art metal prints and pilot achievement plaques. Oh, and I'd appreciate hearing your feedback in my Flying Carpet podcast Facebook group. Follow my social media sites, most of which can be found by searching Greg Brown Flying Carpet. And consider joining my student pilot pep talk group on Facebook. Thanks again for joining me on today's Flying Carpet cockpit adventure. Music by Hannes Brown. See you next time.